Okay, Erev Tov. Firstly, very major Yashakar. Thank you, Elise, for taking the, what's the expression? The bull by the horns. I don't know what expression we're going to use. And reviving this gathering, because it is really quite special. And I'll tell you why it's special. Our minds have been so taken over in the last 4 weeks, 6 weeks, 8 weeks, with so many, I mean, well, COVID, we're talking about months, but I'm saying in the last couple of weeks, I don't know about you, but I'm pretty wiped out from all the, did he win, did he not win, who won, you know, everything about the world that we're in at the moment is, the word surreal doesn't even cover it. And therefore I thought to myself, you know what, if we got a chance to sit and learn and study and put our minds focused on something, I would like to think something which is current, but at the same time coming from Jewish sources, it would just give us a way of refreshing the mind and clearing away all of the cobwebs and debris which we're carrying at the moment with all the other stuff that's going on around us. I hope that was clear. In other words, basically, focus on something else, which I hope will be interesting, just to take us away from what we are otherwise having to focus on in the world around us. And I thought that this subject, I was actually going to cover it 8 months ago, 9 months ago. We got interrupted by something called COVID, and it was a bit of a shame. This was the next item on my list, but I thought that it's a subject which really, it's so, not the word universal, it just is something that affects our lives in so many ways, and very often we don't think about it. And I'll tell you the background to this, when I got really interested in what I would call the Jewish point of view, right? The legal point of view, I think everybody understands. The idea of copyright, what is it all about? We'll come to all of this in a few minutes. But the Jewish concept became a problem. This is going back about 30 years. I spoke last week when I gave the Dvar Torah. I spoke a little bit about my connection with Jonathan Sachs. And one of the things that he was involved with in London was on the advisory committee of a school which was started, not by him, it was started by Emmanuel Jacobus, the previous chief rabbi. And it was really an unbelievable. The school is now up to 700 students, and it's really been a big success, thank God. And at the time, one of the things that we did, we started teaching Talmud both to boys and to girls, which in America had been going on since 1930s with Rav Soloveitchik in Boston and Ramaz and various other schools were doing it. In London, it was the first school that ever did it, 1990. Emmanuel College, it's called. It's a school in Northwest London, and the program really was very innovative. And one of the things I thought would really, I put a lot of thought into how to convey Talmud to a population which may not necessarily have grown up with studying Talmud, particularly girls who are coming into a high school. In England, high school begins at the age of 11, middle school. In the English, it's already called high school. So you've got 11, 12-year-olds, and they're you know, you're throwing Talmud in front of them. So one of the things I thought might make it a little bit easier would be to take a page or two from Art Scroll, which was coming out at the time. I would use Gemara Brachot, which is what we were going to learn, which was already been printed. These are the early days. This is when Art Scroll was beginning in their Talmud production, which is really a phenomenal production. The whole Art Scroll, that side of Art Scroll is really tremendous. And what I decided to do in my naivete, I decided to write to Art Scroll, right, just to, because I read the blurb at the beginning of the Gemara. If you have a Gemara there, you'll be able to read it. And it said basically the whole copyright spiel, and I thought, you know, big deal. I'm going to copy maybe two or three pages of a piece of Talmud. How much are we going to get through? I'm dealing with beginners. And I got a letter back, followed up, I think it was by a phone call, but I don't remember the phone call, but I know I got a letter telling me that if I did this, I would be hearing from their lawyers in London. And I was more than taken aback. I was really, really shocked. Number one, that they had lawyers in London, that was impressive. Don't get me wrong. Wow. But more to the point, the fact that they'd written such a strong letter, it was essentially a legal letter sent to me, told me that as far as they were concerned, there is no question their copyright is not just foolproof, but is, I suppose the expression maybe one would use in legal term, it's actionable, right? I hope that's the right word. They could literally start a court case. I'm copying 2 pages of the Gemara. And to get children and get their parents who are already struggling with school tuitions, because this was a private school, to go and have to buy the art scroll at that time, it was selling at about £40, which was about $60, was really unacceptable. I could not remotely justify that for learning 2 pages in the whole semester. So the whole story got a little bit rough, and I thought to myself, wait a minute, they've made this tremendous assumption, this tremendous whatever word we're going to use, this tremendous presentation to me that that copyright is an obvious, it's a given. And I thought, well, you know, let me look into this. I know from the laws of the land and from what we'll see, what we call Dina de Malchuta, the law of the country, copyright is a given. Go to any copyright machine, copying machine, Xerox machine, or whatever you want to call it, and there should be a sticker on there. Certainly I know in England there was, and I think here as well, giving you the various instructions, you know, don't get involved with copying to the point where copyright laws will be infringed. Fine. And, you know, that's something which I accept as the law of the land, and there's no discussion. But I thought to myself, Oscar, you know, what are you saying to me? Are you saying to me that there is a halachic parameter of copyright as well? And you know what? It should be a no-brainer. You know, you'll say to me, thinking about Psukim in the Torah, I should ask Yaffa, I should ask your brother. He'll come out within 10 seconds. He'll say, obviously, where is the Pasuk? Lo tasig gavur re'echa, right? It says, lo tasig. That means, do not infringe on the boundary of your friend. Which is a law, not necessarily about copyright in the Torah. It's talking about property, right? I have a line between my garden and my friend's garden, and I push the line into his garden. So basically, I'm trying to infringe, to take over his land. And the Torah says, lo tasig, don't do that. That's one of the negative precepts of the Torah. Fine. So you would think that copyright issues in biblical days was not an issue, but as time went on, and what is so interesting is that beginning of printing around the year 1475, whenever printing got going, approximately that time, copyright became, in the Jewish world, a major issue as soon as books started got printing. And that, again, is very, very significant, right? So what did the rabbis do? They looked for precedents. Always, Rabbi Feinstein was very, very famous for this. Try and find somewhere in Talmud which is an allusion to what we are trying to prove as, you know, halachic, what is the halachic dimension of something like copyright? So somebody like Rav Moshe Feinstein presumably would have gone to the Pasuk, Lo Tasig, and it says, do not infringe on the boundary of your friend, and with a statement of Talmud, and you know what? We would have had a teshuva, and we would have had a responsa. And it turns out that it's not so straightforward. I thought this was like an open and shut case. And it really is more complicated than that, because in reality, rabbis have not used that source from the Torah for the purposes of copyright. And the question is why? Surely the principle of not infringing on somebody else's boundary can be expanded as a kind of general principle that somebody has a creation called a book, they produced it, or they're a bookseller and they're trying to print it out to make another sale or whatever it may be. And if I come along and do what they call pirating, I try and do it for myself, surely I'm stealing from them. You know, there's got to be something simple here in religious terms to make it forbidden. And yet, when you look into it, it really is amazingly complicated. I'm not going to give any of the complications this evening, but I just want to share with you some of the concepts, because it really is quite amazing. A couple of stories, because really this works with stories. There was in Hungary a gentleman who, unfortunately, Nebuch was in 1944 was in Budapest and was taken to Auschwitz and died, I think, even on the train on the way to Auschwitz. I think he died on the train. He was a great Gaon, he was a great rabbi known in Hungary as Reb Shlomo Teichdal. Shlomo Teichdal, his name was also Yisachar. Yisachar, Shlomo, Shlomo, Yisachar. What's the story with this rabbi? And it's a very unbelievable story. He grew up in the world of, we're just talking about Satmar Hasidim, right? So in his world, pre-war, Hungary, super from Orthodox in the extreme, and that's the world that he grew up in, and part of that world was very anti-Zionist, as you hear today from certain quarters from there as well, and that's the worldview that he had. Zionism was anathema and it was wrong, and you know all that stuff. It came to the war, and 1939 or even before that, and he changed his mind. And instead of changing his mind on a very sort of placid way, he became an extreme, what we would only describe when you read his writings as a pro-Zionist. Unbelievable. And not only that, but when he wrote his book became really quite phenomenal because he was writing it, he put it together over a number of years, but when it actually was printed, it was printed in 1943 in Budapest. It's just an amazing story. And in the book, he really opens his soul, his heart, to the fact that we should have been more positive towards Eretz Israel, and the rabbis should have encouraged more people to go and live there before the war, and we wouldn't have had this terrible tragedy which has come upon us. And of course you know that he's going to become part of the tragedy in the sense that you know he's going to be killed. And you read this book, it really brings me to tears when I read it. It's been translated into English. It's called Eim HaBanim Smecha, printed 1943 in Hungary. It was printed, I don't know how many copies, you can imagine, must have been very difficult printing in Hungary at that time, and they disappeared. The copies were sold or whatever happened to them, and the book just disappeared from the shelves. 1983, in Israel, all of a sudden the book reappears. The copy, the 1943 copy, is being reprinted. Obviously somebody had it and decided this was now maybe a good time to reprint it. No permission from the family. The family survived. They had two sons that are living in Israel, right? Maybe they went to Israel before the war, or they escaped. Not sure of the whole story. It's a complicated story. But the two sons living in Israel became incredibly upset. Again, why? Because they are part of the world in which their father lived in. Now in Israel, there's a very big Haredi community called the Badats, you know, that whole Haredi community in Meir Shearim. And these two sons wanted to reproduce their father's book, but on condition that it has the introduction which they are going to write to explain their father's view on Zionism, right? Because they wanted to explain to everybody what their father really believed. And the book, which was printed in 1983, based on the 1943 edition, did not have the introduction. So they went to Beis Din. They decided that whoever printed that book, they found out who it was, and they took them to Beis Din. They went to the Jewish court in Yerushalayim in order to get the book stopped printing, right? And whatever judgment they wanted to get, in presumably some sort of compensation, whatever, and they wanted to have essentially a copyright issued on the version of the book which they were going to print, which in fact did get printed in the end, with the introduction which had been written to explain their father's point of view. So this became a cause celebre in Israel in the 1980s. One of the rabbis on the Beis Din, who Nebuch died, a very young man, Reb Shila Rafael, one of the really outstanding Talmidei Chachamim in Eretz Israel at the time. He was remarkable. He was also, I think, a shul rabbi in Kiryat Moshe. Very outstanding scholar. And someone who really understood not only the Jewish concept, but the bigger picture. He really was very unique. And he died very young, Nebuch. But this court case happened. He was still around. And he wrote his opinion. And what I'm going to tell you this evening is really very much bound with the opinion that he wrote. Basically, what happened was that he couches his opinion based on this court case that was sent to him, asking the very basic question, does such a thing as copyright, what is called in Hebrew, Zechut HaYotzer, the privilege of one who creates something, does it exist in Jewish law? right? That was the question which really he was raising in his opinion, which he was writing about the court case dealing with this book, which had been reprinted without the introduction, which should have been there, and the family wanted to get it stopped, and the printing to be done the way that they had wanted it to done, with permissions, etc., and not based on the original edition from 1943. So what Rabbi Shiloh Raphael does is he goes through the history of copyright. Now this is where it really gets interesting. You know, think about it. This is a modern issue, right? We know with intellectual property and all these sort of things that we discuss. And with computers and internet, it's even getting more complicated. And I was just thinking, you know, there's three companies making COVID vaccine. Is there such a concept that, you know, each one can protect its creation against the other company? They're very similar, but are they exactly the same? One COVID vaccine is stored at whatever it is, minus 70, whatever it is, centigrade. I'm just reading about this. Another vaccine can be stored at normal temperature. How does each company protect its creation? All right, so that's not necessarily a copyright issue, but it's just interesting how in the world that we live in, all of these things have become so, you know, kind of things that we understand. These are issues which can become lawsuits if it gets complicated, and protecting the rights of creation. That's really what I'm going to call it. But I'm going to stay with the Jewish stuff because this is fascinating. We're going to go back to the year 1580. This is what Rabbi Shiloh Raphael does. He gives you a history. He says in the year 1580, there was a court case in Krakow. 1580, that's 400 years ago, right? Over 400. And who was the rabbi in Krakow? The very famous rabbi, Ramosha Isilis, the famous Ramon, the man who wrote down the Shulchan Aruch for the Ashkenazim. You can't really get sort of more a serious bearded gentleman, more serious than that, right? And Ramon had a court case which was brought to him by someone who was objecting to a printer who was pirating, I'm going to use the word because it's hysterical, pirating copies of the Rambam. The Rambam's text, Yad Chazaka, right, 14 volumes of halachic decisions of Maimonides, was being pirated. Now, go figure who had the copyright, who had the permission to reprint it, is not very clear, but a printer had appeared from nowhere, and he was putting out all of these copies of the books based on the printing presses that he had, presumably somewhere in Poland, because it was brought to the Ramo, who lived in Krakow, in southern Poland. And what the Ramon did, what Rabbi Isilis did, he said, listen, I've got to make a decision here whether this pirated edition of Maimonides' work is allowable. Can I allow the printer to produce it or not? And he found a statement in the Talmud which is fascinating. The statement in the Talmud, again, as I said, they always look for precedent. So the statement in the Talmud makes a distinction when a person affects another person's livelihood. There are two possibilities. One possibility is that you affect the livelihood, meaning that you destroy the other person's livelihood, right? You set up competition and you undercut the guy completely, therefore the other person goes out of business. Or the other option is that you affect his livelihood in the sense that you create competition. So he won't make $1 million this year, he'll only make $500,000. And you'll make the other $500,000. So you've reduced his income, but you haven't destroyed his business. And the Talmud has a big discussion as to in what case might we be more lenient, and in what case will we definitely not allow that if it comes to a Bet Din, what the Bet Din would say. So I think it's pretty obvious that if Reuven destroys Shimon's livelihood, that would be unacceptable. And that would be the end of the court case, and the courts would decide that is, you know, as we say, actionable, and it would go against the person who made the competition. And without getting into the complications of that particular case, says Rabbi Isilis, this is what's happening with the Rambam. What's happening with the Rambam is that this volume of Maimonides, probably a lot of volumes, these were being sold at a cut price. Right? You know, go down to the local Sforim store in Krakow, Main Street, whatever street that is. I've actually been to Krakow, and you can see it. If you've seen Schindler's List, you'll be able to see the streets of Krakow as they were with Jews. Remarkable town. 60,000 Jews living in Krakow before World War II. 12 shuls literally within the space of, I think, 2 square miles. 12, and not insignificant shuls. Each shul was holding 400 or 500 people. So you can just imagine what it was like on Shabbos in Krakow. It was just beyond belief. And Rabbi Isserles basically made the decision that since this copy of the Rambam was being pirated and was done without permission from anybody, they should have gone to the rabbi or somebody to get permission to copy it, particularly if somebody else was already producing the copies, you know, making his business out of selling copies of Rambam, and he established himself as being the printer. So printer number one, Reuven, was doing it already. Printer number two, Shimon, was told under no uncertain terms, stop your production, you are not allowed to continue printing. And in those days, the rabbis had the, what you call in Hebrew, egrafim, they had the kayach, they had the strength to do it, and apparently that decision was accepted. So you can see that in the earliest day, this is like not even 100 years after printing began, we're already getting into discussions about svarim. Jewish books, is there a concept of protecting the print? Protecting the printer in this case. Protecting the person. And if it is printing something which, you know, like everybody will be interested in what Rambam writes, and printing made these books so much more accessible than they were before 1470 or whatever the date was, then, says Rabbi Isserles, this becomes a very significant decision to be made, and he made it forbidden for printer number two to undercut and sell his version of the copy of Maimonides' writings, which were already being produced by printer number one. So says Rabbi Sheila Raphael, that's clear that according to Rabbi Isserles, there is a concept of copyright, right? But of course he said, wait a minute, that's something that was already being produced. Here comes the interesting question. Rambam lived in the 1200s, and this was a book being printed in the 1500s. So we're talking about 300 years after the Rambam died. That is, again, a discussion about something which already exists, whether the printer could protect his printing press from attack from someone outside. However, says Rabbi Raphael, he says, wait a minute. He says, what we are dealing with is something slightly different nowadays, and that is the question of copyright on something which is completely new. Every, I would say in Israel, probably every week, maybe even every day, there is a book being produced in Israel, maybe, certainly in the yeshiva world. Right, there's just an enormous literature, maybe very specific about different areas of Talmud or different areas of Jewish law, whatever it may be. But these books are being produced, and the question then is not about something which already exists, but something which is new. Can you protect your creation from someone else also wanting to take the book and copy it out and make it into a book to be sold? Can you protect your creation, your own sefer? I have an interesting story, and it's again one of my favorite stories. I was flying from London to Israel, and I was online at El Al, and there's a guy in front of me, and I'm looking at this guy, and I know this guy, and I haven't seen him in 35 years. So, you know, this probably happens. I'm sure everybody has kind of a similar story. So I'm looking at him, I say, we know each other. He says, yeah, I remember you. We were together in yeshiva in the north of England. I said, where are you now? He says, I'm in Yerushalayim. I said, really? What are you doing in Jerusalem? Out of interest, he was from Manchester. He said to me, he's in the Mir. I said, whoa, you're in the Mir? How long have you been in the Mir? The yeshiva. He said, about since we were together in yeshiva, 35 years. I said, 35 years in the Mir. Wow. I asked him one question, and that ended the conversation. I said, where is your sefer? Where is the book that you've written in the last 35 years? You've got to have written a book, something. You know, in 35 years, you've gone over those Gemaras over and over and over and over and over. You've got to have specialized in something. You can't just stay on the same Baba Kama forever. You've got to do something to make your mark on the Jewish world. And that ended the conversation, because clearly he was a bit upset with me, because I'd asked him the question that really, I don't know, maybe I shouldn't have asked, but I felt it was important, because being in that environment and committing yourself to that type of lifestyle, surely one of the aims would be to increase scholarship in the Jewish world. I mean, you know, again, back to Rabbi Sacks, he had 30 books published, and I'm guaranteed, and this is the tragedy of what happened a few weeks ago, he's probably had another 30 books which we'll never see. Because, you know, this was a guy who was really, all the time, he was working on, I don't know, all different things. It's an incredible loss for the Jewish world, incredible. But back to this story. I have an interesting PS to that, by the way, because I told this story over in Fairlawn, where we were living, at a shiur, and one of the guys came up to me afterwards and he presented me with a book. About a week later, I said, "What is this book?" He said, "It's my son-in-law. He's been in Merkaz Arav Yeshiva for about 10 or 12 years." And I told him, he told him the story that I'd said about this guy I met on the line going back to the Mir. And at that point, the son-in-law had told his father-in-law, "Well, you should know, I've just printed a book. I've just written a book and it's been printed." And he gave me a copy, maybe it was 2 or 3 weeks later. But whatever it was, I have the sefer with me. It was on Talmud, it was very specific. It's the sort of book that maybe I wouldn't have bought, I wouldn't have been interested, unless I'm really learning that particular section. But it doesn't matter. Because that was a contribution to Jewish scholarship. And I was really, really overwhelmed by that. I thought that was really something. But again, back to the point, producing something, protecting it by dint of copyright. How does it work in the Jewish world? And here comes the crunch. And the crunch is like this. Most people, most opinions will turn around and say, of course, there's got to be copyright protection. But on what basis? On what basis can we have copyright protection? So again, we look for precedents. The story with Rabbi Isserles in 1580 was a story of something that had already been produced and was being reproduced. But what about a brand new book? So here comes a story from the 1800s. And it's so amazing how the Jewish law, Jewish courts really were dealing with this a long time ago. And the story goes like this. Those of you who recognize the Shulchan Aruch, we know the Code of Jewish Law. And we all know that the Code of Jewish Law has got, you know, a dozen commentaries on the page. Okay, famous, not so famous. And when you study Shulchan Aruch, you become a rabbi, you've got to study all this stuff. There's a lot of stuff to study, no question about it. One of those commentaries on Shulchan Aruch, Orach Chaim, on really one of the basic laws of Shabbat and Chagim and whatever, a commentary came out in the 1800s called the Pri Megadim. And this is really was a wow. Pri Megadim, written by, and again I've got the name of the rabbi here, can't remember now what his name was, don't have it written down. Basically, this Pri Megadim, this book was a wow because he brought all the opinions which had been written from the days of Shulchan Aruch in the 1500s to the days of his book when it came out in the 1800s, 300 years of opinions on different parts of Jewish law, and he put it all together and he made a new book called the Pri Megadim, which is available on Shulchan Aruch. I have a copy here. And the reality of it was brand new, and he wanted to protect his creation. He wanted to make sure that nobody would start producing it, you know, without permission and whatever. And he went to the rabbis of his day. One of the great rabbis that he went to was Rabbi Shaul Natanzer. Rabbi Shaul Natanzer was really one of the famous, famous rabbis in Poland in the 1800s. And he made a decision. He's known as the Sholem Meshiv. Everyone who studies Responder will know about this particular rabbi. And his decision was really very interesting, and it was kind of obvious. And the comment that he made, he says that if we don't protect a person's right of what he has produced in terms of a book or whatever, then nobody is going to be publishing books. Because why would I go and publish my book and make a deal with a publisher and then have a whole to do with the pricing and everything else if somebody will come along, who hasn't got permission to do any of this stuff, and he goes and reproduces my book at half price. I am basically going to be out of pocket. I'm going to have real issues with what I've done, the whole production, etc. And Rav Natanzer said, if we don't give the person who made the book that sense of protection, then people are just going to stop writing books. It's as simple as that. Or certainly stop publishing books. It'll be manuscripts, and they'll keep the manuscript, and who knows whether we'll ever see it, whether we'll ever get published. And basically, Rabbi Natanzin said, we've got to give this man protection in terms of his book, his commentary, and that was the decision that was made. However, as we always know, when there's two rabbis, there's three opinions, right? So what happens next is that another rabbi gets involved. And another rabbi who gets involved is very interesting rabbi. He's known by the name of his book, the Beis Yitzchak. His name was Yitzchak Shmelkes. Love that name. Rabbi Yitzchak Shmelkes. Imagine him growing up with a name like that. And the reality was, this Rabbi Yitzchak Shmelkes was a very famous rabbinic posek. He really made some major decisions in Jewish law. And he comes along and he says, wait a minute. He says, I'm not happy with this decision of Rabbi Natanzin. And he tells you why. And this is where I blow my mind. He says, every day in davening, look how basic it gets. We say every day in the davening, we say, Hashem chofetz leman sikho, right? Everybody knows this pasuk. Yagdil Torah v'yadir. Right? God chofetz leman sikho, desires for the sake of tzedek, of righteousness. Whatever that means, that's one part of the pasuk. Yagdil Torah v'yadir. May Torah increase v'yadir and become strong. Adir. Adir who we sing on Pesach. So, says Rabbi Natan, says Rabbi Shmelkes, he says, Yagdil Torah. If we are true to that particular pasuk, we will want Torah to be strong. We will want Torah to be widespread, to be disseminated as much as possible. Copyright goes against that. He says, by definition, copyright restricts people's access to Torah. Because if I limit the book to the person producing it, so he'll produce 100 copies or 1,000, and then he runs out of money, right? And then the book's gone. And then you have to wait 10 years until the book is reprinted. And will it be reprinted? And all of the stuff that happens with printing, as we know to this very day. So said Rabbi Shmelkes, and it's an unbelievable statement. His comment was, and again, let me bring it up on screen, because I just want to show you this. Let me see if I can... screen sharing is not happening, so it doesn't matter. I'll have to leave that for the moment. I don't know whether at least we can do screen sharing, but if we don't worry about it. Let's see if we can get that.
If whoever is hosting can make Rabbi Schaffer a co-host, he could share it.
Yeah. Let me try that again. No, still not happening.
You should be able to do it now.
Ah, okay. Let me... Oh, perfect. Thank you so much. Thank you. All right, have a look at this. This is the page. And again, I don't want to overdo the Hebrew text, because you can imagine this is kind of a bit intense, but I just want to show you this. It's a short paragraph, and this is the, as I said, Beit Yitzchak. Beit Yitzchak, this is the book written by this Rabbi Yitzchak Shmelkes. Now listen to what he writes. Right? Rabbi Yitzchak Shmelkes, that was the rabbi's name. Cholek Bezel Sholomesha. He disagrees with Rabbi Natanzin. L'da'ato yesh lechalek. He says, he wants to make a distinction. Bein hamtza'a regila. He said, under normal circumstances, one has the right to a patent, right? We have lawyers, patent lawyers, and all the rest of it. That's a normal creation, and you protect your creation. We know that such a concept exists, and he's writing about this in Poland 140 years ago. But he says there's a difference between regular stuff like that, what we would call patents, lebein divrei Torah. And the distinction with that and general words of Torah. What does it say about Torah? Shenema bo, re'ei limadati etchem chukim u'mishpatim. God says, look, I'm teaching you these laws and these judgments. This is Moshe talking. Kashet sivani Hashem, as God has commanded me. So the rabbis say, v'dorshu chazal, ma ani b'chinam, afatem nami b'chinam. That Torah, Moshe said, I didn't pay a penny for the Torah. So I'm getting this fantastic present from God called the Torah. So I want to share it with you, b'chinam, for no cost. Obviously, what does that mean? That when it comes to making sure that everybody has access to Torah, there should be no financial burden whatsoever. Wow. That's a pretty staggering statement. Art Scroll would definitely not be happy with that. But it says, V'chein, Moshe nohag bo b'Torah tovat ein. Moshe dealt with Torah with a good eye. In other words, he was generous. V'natna l'Yisrael, he gave it over to Israel. V'alav ha-katuv omer, and the verse says, Tov ayin hu yivorah. Right? That the man of a good eye will be blessed. Wow. Says Rabbi Yitzchak Shmelkes, Hosef Beit Yitzchak, says the rabbi, after Perushe Divrei Sofrim, Mutar Litol Schar, and he gives a whole discussion about getting paid, teachers are allowed to get paid in Jewish law. Thank God for that. That's a whole another shir for another occasion. But he says, I'll just go down to the bottom thing here. He says, and this is the conclusion of Rabbi Shmelkes. Rabbi Shmelkes' conclusion is that according to these traditions of Torah being available b'chinam, for no cost, then there should be absolutely no concept when it comes to Torah literature of limiting anyone can come along. Anyone can produce the book. Anyone can print it. Think about that. He says, so what do we, how do we limit it today? And he says, Ella, if there is a law of copyright, the only basis, says Rabbi Shmelkes, where this law will exist, Sha'ava Beit Yisrael Kotev, he writes, the Osa Davar, the only reason why I can say I can't print somebody else's book just at a whim, because I can do it cheaper and undercut the other guy, if it's a Torah book, because Midin, Dina de Malchuta Dina, the law of the land. And that is what is so interesting. You'll find when you look at Hebrew books, they're being produced, as I said, at a phenomenal rate. One a week, you know, go to the Shavua Sefer, this wonderful week in Israel. I think it's around the end of May, when they literally everywhere they're selling books. It's just it's so uplifting. And it's Sfarim. It's books on Torah, but it's also other books, right? That Israel is translated into Hebrew, every writer that you could ever imagine. And a lot of them you can't imagine, right? There's so much stuff going on there. And the end of the day, when you look particularly at the Hebrew Sfarim, it is so interesting, their comment when it comes to copyright. They usually put a phrase which says, Zechut Yotzrim or Zechut HaYotzer, Lefi Din Torah. They'd say it's according to the law of the Torah, copyright exists, and they don't explain. The one book which I found where it was honest, following Rabbi Shmelkes, was a Siddur produced by one of the companies that produces the Siddurim in Israel. And there it writes that this is copyright Lefi Chukei HaMedina, or words to that effect, according to the laws of the country. So, of course, in Israel, it's not Torah law because we're talking about, it's not about marriage laws, which are Torah law in Israel, but it's talking about legal laws, right? Laws of copyright, so they are bound by secular law in Israel. Fine. But whatever it is, the reality of copyright, according to the decision which is given by Rabbi Shmelkes, is not so obvious. It's not going to be because it's obvious that you have to protect the person's right to produce something and to print it and whatever, because, you know, that's clearly a requirement when a person publishes a book. The answer, says Rabbi Shmelkes, is no. If we're talking about Torah, there is a special requirement that Torah should be like Moshe Rabbeinu, should be given to everybody, and there should be no charge. If you've got something to say which is relevant to the Jewish world, then make sure everybody hears it without having to get into a discussion about how much it's going to cost. And therefore, if you want to know, says Rabbi Shmelkes, when he was writing, around about 1860, 1870 in Poland, why copyright should exist in any way whatsoever, it must be because as Jews, we have to follow the law of the land. And that's something which, again, is a whole discussion for another time, where the law of the land kicks in, where as Jews, generally speaking, you know, we go out of the road, it's a red light. I can't say because I'm Jewish, I can go through the red light. This is a big issue now, by the way, what we're speaking about before with COVID. The law of the land, or at least the law of the state, is to wear masks and to not have big gatherings. And for reasons which are beyond my understanding, our many religious brethren are having a lot of issues with this, and I don't understand it. I don't understand what sakanat nefashot, the problem with translating that phrase really is, but this will get my blood pressure going, so I'm going to stay off that subject. I apologize. But listen to this. What we're actually seeing, and I'm going to go back to the shared screen. What we're seeing, which is fascinating, is a tremendously wide-ranging discussion, initially about producing a book which had already been produced for many years prior to when the discussion took place. That was the story in Krakow. And then the second discussion was about producing a book which was brand new. And then the question would be, can you protect the right of the person who made the book to be able to produce it and to give it to a publisher and whatever without somebody coming along and undercutting the whole enterprise? And the decision there was a very major argument between two of the greatest rabbis in Poland in the middle of the 1800s. Rabbi Natanzin said, no question, you've got to protect the rights, otherwise books will never be published. And he had a very good logic for that. Rabbi Shmelke said, but Torah's got to be b'chinam. Moshe Rabbeinu set the paradigm. Torah's given for no charge, right? You don't send a bill afterwards. And the only reason why we pay teachers, and there's a whole discussion about that, and thank God that discussion came out on the plus side. But the reality of it is that, says Rabbi Shmelkes, you know what? Why do we have a law of copyright? The only reason would be we're living in a country where copyright is the law of the land. It blows my mind because none of them, no Rabbi Isserles, Rabbi Natanzin, and Rabbi Shmelkes, three of the greatest rabbinical deciders of the last 500 years, did not go immediately to the Torah and say that you mustn't move your boundary onto somebody's from your side to the other side. They didn't take any of that, what most people would say is obvious, hasagat gavul, stretching the boundary and therefore by definition taking over somebody else's property as being the basis for copyright. Nobody says that. And it wasn't obvious to them because maybe the answer is that that's not the law which we can base, you know, the original Torah law, which we can then base the law of copyright on. I hope the point I'm making is clear, that copyright doesn't come from an obvious place. It's a discussion where we get to the bottom line, and the bottom line is that it may just be the law of the land. In other words, not even a law which we as Jews have put into Shulchan Aruch, but it's something which we have to observe because the people around us, where we're living, are protecting their creation with copyright. Yes, Yaffa, please.
Rabbi, so according to Rabbi Shmelkes, I like his name.
Isn't that a great name?
So what constitutes Torah copying? Is it just the actual Torah, or is it commentary which somebody thought of, which isn't in the Torah?
Correct. It's the whole range of Torah literature, what we would call Torah Shebichtav, Torah Shebalpeh, everything. Even Torah Shebichtav in the last 20 years, meaning the basic Chumash, right? The basic Chumash, tell you the truth, there was a copyright discussion about that. If you come from the world of the Yekis, which maybe some of you do, there is a standard of Chumash which was known as the Rödelheim print. Rödelheim was in Germany, and this Chumash in its day was the most exact Chumash. Again, ask Abe, and I'm sure he'll tell you all about it, because it was precious. Rödelheim. My wife went to Breuer's to the school, and one year they gave a souvenir, you know, to the kids at the dinner, and the souvenir was the Rödelheim Sidur, and all the instructions are in German. It's just unbelievable. This was given out in Washington Heights in the 1960s, go figure. But they gave it out with German instructions, you know, very useful for kids being brought up in New York. But the reality of it was that there was even a discussion about that, right, in terms of reproducing it. Someone wanted to produce this very famous Chumash, but cut price, right? And therefore, you just leave the front page out. You just cut out the word Rödelheim. Everybody knows it is the Rödelheim Chumash, but they were trying to produce it and sell it so that they could undercut what was otherwise a product which was being charged at a certain rate, I don't know, 100 rubles, and they wanted to sell it for 50 rubles. So what I'm saying is it goes right across the whole range of Jewish literature, this discussion, be it the regular Chumash that we would expect to find in Shul, be it Torah literature, which is enormous in the yeshiva, whatever, it ranges across everything. And what I'm trying to show you is how complicated something which would should be really quite simple in terms of principle, how complicated it really is when you factor in the concept that Torah should be something which is available for everybody. That I love the idea of it. But as a publisher, and as a, you know, if I was the article publisher reading that, I would have had some sleepless nights. All I need is someone to come along and say to me, "How?" Back to my story. I write back to them and say, "Thank you for warning me that you've got lawyers in London, but what about Rabbi Shmelkes? He was a great rabbi, and he said Torah should be for everybody, right? And you're telling me that if I photocopy 2 pages of your Gemara, you're going to sue me? Really? Is that really what you're saying to me?" And I didn't write that back because at the time, you know, I didn't know Rabbi Shmelkes and didn't know.
Isn't there a quantity actually that constitutes copyright?
Yeah, now that's where Art Scroll have consulted lawyers, because they actually, when you look at their, and they're the only ones I've seen that really do this very exact, they give you certain parameters where copying would be allowed. But it's so limited for my purpose that I wanted it for, if they would have said no. They really would have said no, even if it's... And, you know, to me, it just didn't make sense. I understand what they were saying, but this is where, you know, this is where you've got to balance it out. This is the Rabbi Shmelkes concept. I want Torah to be available to students who are... I'm teaching girls Gemara. They never studied Gemara in their lives. And all of a sudden, I want it to be available to them, so I want to facilitate in such a way that they would be able to begin with a book that explains it so clearly and so beautifully. Yeah. You know what? They would end up buying the book themselves anyway, I'm sure, in the end.
Art Scroll should make a student copy, you know, with each daf as a separate unit.
Let's not discuss Art Scroll business.
Vocabulary and all that.
I just got their pamphlet for the Hanukkah sale. I better not. I'm on record here. I'm going to behave myself. Aaron, sorry, you got your hand up.
Yeah. So perhaps Hasagas Kabbalah isn't being invoked, because isn't it the case that for, you know, the Bar Mitzvah, there's no Hasagas Kabbalah. One shul can't keep another shul from opening a school. You can't keep another school.
Yeah.
But what I'm surprised that hasn't come up in the discussion is, doesn't Rambam have very strong words for someone who attempts to make money off of you know, this teaching of Torah and using Torah to, you know, make money?
Yeah, he really does. Oh, yeah. I actually got it on the handout. I think I've got that piece right. As I said, I don't want to get into that area, because that leads us into the whole question of paying teachers for Jewish studies, which has been a very controversial subject over the years. And as I said, thank God, in the world that we live in, you know, the way that we show our appreciation to the teacher is by paying, you know, ideally some sort of living wage, so that, you know, they can be appreciated. But your comment about the Rambam is 100% correct. But it's a tangent. I don't want to go there, because that's a whole discussion. But thank you. It's really important that you've raised something very significant. I look at the time. I want to end with another item which is fascinating. We've all heard of the Chofetz Chaim in one way or another. Famous rabbi, who was he? Yisrael Meir Kagan. Lived in Poland, in Radin, till the age of, some say he was 95. The New York Times reported his death in 1933. They said he was 105. So go figure, right? When was he born? Nobody really knows. Between Purim and Pesach, you know, that's what they usually said. When were you born? Sometime, you know, they give that kind of definition. This rabbi, he was married twice. His first wife died when very young, and he got remarried. And the Rebbetzin really was apparently quite a remarkable woman. And what I didn't realize is that she had either managed to escape because her husband, he died in 1933, the Chofetz Chaim. Rabbi Kagan died, but she outlived him. So I'm assuming that there's a story, and I'm trying to find it. I looked online, I couldn't find anybody writing about it. She arrived in New York. She managed to get to America in 1941. Now, whether this was via, you know, whatever way it was, I mean, who knows how it was, whether she went to Palestine for, I don't know. I don't know the whole story. And of course, those who went to YU will know Rabbi Zaks, Mendel Zaks, who actually was a son-in-law of the Chofetz Chaim, who was a teacher at YU for many, many years. The Rebbetzin came to America, And she brought with her must have been a manuscript, I guess, handwritten copy of a sefer of the Chofetz Chaim, which had not been published. What did he publish? The book that everybody knows, the book of Jewish law, called the Mishnah Berurah. That is a book which gives you the literally nitty-gritty from the moment you wake up to the moment you go to sleep, Shabbos, Yontov, Chagim, etc., printed, and of course nowadays with fantastic translation, available in every shul in the world. That was published under the condition, the Chofetz Chaim said, that there would be no copyright. He made a specific requirement that whoever wants to publish this book is allowed to publish it for the sake of spreading halakha, Jewish law. Now, the interesting question was that the Rebbetzin, in 1946, just after the end of the war, wanted to publish the manuscript that she had from her husband, but it wasn't a book of Jewish law, it was a book of what we call Musa. It was a book about, you know, the Chofetz Chaim was famous for his thing about Lashon Hara, not speaking bad about other people. So he wrote a book called Shmirat HaLashon. And this was a very well-known book, which people have on their bookshelf. Again, with wonderful, nowadays, with wonderful translations in English and whatever. And in 1946, she wanted to print it. And the question was asked at the time that if she does print it, what did her husband say about the situation of copyright? Was her husband happy that she would print it and everybody else would then go and reprint it without reference to the Rebbetzin or not? And amazingly, and people are really still questioning this, Rabbi Kagan left a written something that he gave to her to say that when you get to America, you know, if you do get to America and you publish this book, then you have to make sure that there is a protection on it that nobody else will publish it. And everybody asked the question, wait a minute, when it came to the book of Jewish law, free and easy, everyone can publish it, you can get copies, and you'll see if you have old copies of Mishnah Berurah, they were published in all strange and wondrous places, right? Even today they're still doing new editions of the original. But why was he so almost contradicting himself by saying that this other book, he's protecting the rights of the Rebbetzin to publish it and make sure that nobody else does it? And this is the question. I'll show you again. Just go on screen for 2 seconds and then I'm done. But I want to show you this because this is fascinating.
He died in 1945.
The Chofetz Chaim died in 33. There is a famous a piece in the New York Times which actually reports it in 1933. It's a very interesting thing which you can look up. But have a look at this. And this is a fascinating story from 1946, Tafshin Vav. And Makor Acharon Lezchut HaYotzrim. This is Rabbi Raphael, who is giving us a final reference when it comes to copyright. Efshar Lavi Mikhtavash Almanat Chofetz Chaim, the widow of the Chofetz Chaim. So we'll find out what was his opinion about copyright. He was a big rabbi. What does he say? B'sefer Avat Chesed shel Chofetz Chaim. I wasn't the Shmirat HaLashon. It's a book called Avat Chesed. Again, he wrote something like 13 or 14 books. So this is one of the famous ones. Avat Chesed. It was nidpas al yedei Rabbanit Freida Kagan. Alei Shalom. But New York, Tavshin Va. It was published in New York in 1946. Right? So that means that she survived. She got out of Poland and got to New York. So it says, Kotevet hi bakdama biyiddish. She gives an introduction in Yiddish. Sheba'ala natan la ba'ofen biladi. Her husband insisted that she has the absolute control, letamid, for perpetuity, forever, et zechut had pasat svara, to print his books. Nobody can do it except the Rebbetzin. And she's the only one who can sell it. Fascinating. But that was the point. He understood that this would be for her a source of income, parnosa. And in such a circumstance, you've got Rabbi Shmuelka saying Torah should be for everybody, but the Chofetz Chaim, he knew what Rabbi Shmuelka said, he probably knew him personally, but the reality was he said no. when it came to Parnassa, and she would need supporting somehow when she's living in America, or wherever she would end up living, he insisted that in publishing this other book, not a book of Jewish law, but a book of ethics and chesed, all about kindness and whatever, that should be under her control, what we would nowadays call an absolute copyright on the book. And it says, Af echad lechein hi mosifa, therefore she adds in her introduction in Yiddish, note, that, ein lo reshut ladpis shum sefer shel Chofetz Chaim, nobody can reproduce any of the books of her husband, kulo or miktzato, partially or complete, b'shum safa shei, whatever language. You want to do it in Yiddish, you want to do it in Chinese, doesn't matter. Lo b'medina polin, either in Poland, v'lo b'medina tachirod, or anywhere else, right? Poland was the place till 1939. Harei lanu shalachov etz chayim zal, haya pashut, the obvious chayim was obvious, sheyesh lo zechud yotzrim, that there is a concept of copyright. Af al yitzirato, something which was new, that he had written. V'yaf echad lo yechol litom meito zchud zu, nobody can take away this particular zchud, this merit. And therefore, again, fascinating that the Chofetz Chaim on one hand allows Mishnah Berurah to be published by everybody, and then when it comes to this book, which his widow had brought with her to America, as part of the books of the Chofetz Chaim, which are now published quite regularly, and yeshiva boys learn these all the time, the reality of it is that should be published only with the permission of the family. Now again, move on from 1946 to 2020, and I'm not sure what the deal is today, whether the family of the family still have control of that or not, that I don't know. But it's again, just fascinating. I'm just going to go back. Sorry, stop the share screen. I'm just going to sort of say in the end that it's a very, it shouldn't be, but it looks like it's a bit of a minefield. It should be obvious that if you make something and you produce it, there should be the ability to protect what you're producing in terms of the laws of copyright, whether the laws are, wherever they would come from in the Torah. It seems obvious that there must be a precedent in Torah to protect someone's creation of something new in the Torah library. However, as you can see, this is not straightforward at all. And if you take the opinion of Rabbi Shmelkes, particularly, who is so extreme in saying that Torah should be bechinam, Moshe Rabbeinu gave it to everybody, he got it for nothing, give it away for nothing, and everything else, then you get into a very interesting discussion. And as I said, what I hope this shiur will do, number one, is just taking your mind off anything else, just thinking about this for an hour, I hope it's been interesting. But more to the point, whenever you pick up a Jewish book, just look at the art scroll. We've all got an art scroll book somewhere at home. Check the copyright, what they've written. Because it is very, once you now know a bit of the background, you'll get some flavor of what they've actually done. Because of all the copyrights that I've seen, that's the one that I think is, from a Jewish perspective, I'm going to say the most interesting. It's kind of almost the most restrictive I've ever read, but it's also very interesting because when you see all the background, what's going on over here, the whole subject, as I said, shouldn't be, but it's become a bit of a minefield. And all I can say is, I give a blessing to everybody, that one day, hopefully, we'll all have the problem. We'll have the problem, Bezrat Hashem, that we can all produce Torah knowledge and Torah literature, whatever it may be. Everybody has a chelik. We always say this every day in davening. V'sein chalkeinu b'Torah techa. Tein chalkeinu b'Torah techa. Grant our portion in Torah. So whatever it may be, that we can produce something, whatever element, whatever level we may achieve, let's hopefully all be in the position where we will have this discussion and be able to increase the knowledge of Torah and expand that awareness, Bezrat Hashem, throughout the Jewish world, that it becomes a problem for us, because then it means that we've done something right. Whether I'm absolutely excited about the limitations, as I said, the story with Art Scroll, I'm just going to refrain from comment in the end, leave it the way it was, and in the end we actually did something else. And in fact, I just want to bring it to your attention, the final comment, where this has been a very big issue with a web page, which is so amazing, being produced at the moment in Israel, and there are people working in America on it, I mentioned it before, I think, called Sefaria. SCF.
I was just going to ask you about Safari.
And they have even produced on their website a complete Talmud Hebrew English. And it's not Art Scroll, I have to say. They didn't get Art Scroll.
But they have the copyright of all the things.
Now, that's the thing that they are working on, because I think that's why they have to raise the money. Not only to pay the people to do the translation, but also to cover the copyrights of so many of the books, which they are now incorporating into that particular project. But the project is fantastic. I'm just in the middle of grading what I can only describe my nachas when I teach. I get papers from my students, a midterm paper. And I said to all of them, I said that if you don't have Sfaria on your bibliography of what you've been looking up, then you won't get an A.
Yeah.
Because you've got to get to know this page. It doesn't matter who you are, what it's got, and it's getting bigger the whole time. And, you know, so you send them $18 every so often. They're very appreciative. Because the reality of it is that it's a phenomenal resource.
Yeah.
And Yagdil Torah v'yadeh, it really increases the knowledge of Torah wherever you go. Art Scroll have done it.
I tried to translate Rashi on one of my Safaria notes that I was, you know, handing out to people.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't allow it.
Oh, really?
Whatever was not on there, they wouldn't allow. I had to write things in my own words. I could not.
Very interesting. Because what they're doing is they're collecting the work that people are putting together, right, in order to put it on their webpage so that teachers are not recreating the wheel every 5 minutes, right?
Exactly.
Worksheets and whatever. So, it's, as I said, it is a bit of a minefield. But on the other hand, thank God for people like Sfaria, who instead of having this very limited, you know, sort of blinkered approach, are trying to make things available in the widest possible way, reflecting the Rav Shmelkes, reflecting his whole, because he reflects a whole attitude, not just himself, but at the same time also Dina de Malchuta, aware of the fact that bottom line, we've got to be aware of copyright issues and, you know, be sensitive towards them. And I think that's really the compromise which I'm happy to live with. But as I said, this is again a very unusual topic. Been around in the Jewish world ever since books were printed. It was an issue for Jews, and look at the literature that we've gone through. Fascinating. Any final comments? Because I just want to leave it at that. Just to say to you, 2 weeks' time, I think, Elise, right? 2 weeks. We're gonna do some Hanukkah stuff. Hanukkah's coming. Why not do some Hanukkah stuff?
Something joyous.
Something really to look forward to. I hate this comment we're all making now, which is, where are we going to be Pesach? Where, you know, are we still going to be doing the Seder on our own? I pray to God by then, with the vaccine. I've got to ask Dr. Panish sitting there. Are we? Hopefully, we're in a good position. Bezrat Hashem. Let's. You know, when we daven every day, I really think about every morning. We say Borei Refuot. Borei Refuot means not just we pray for healing, but Borei. Borei means Yesh Me'ayin. Sometimes it's got to come out of almost out of nowhere, right? Like God created the world, something from nothing. So let's hope, Borei Refuot, that the wonderful people working on this project around the world, they will be efficacious, it will work, and we can talk about this as a in the past tense and not in the present tense anymore. Please God, b'mehera b'yomeinu. Let's leave it at that.
It would be a miracle if it came out of Israel, but we'll take it from anywhere.
Wherever. Doesn't matter. I don't care where it comes from.
As long as it's not China.
And as long as it's not China.
Yeah,
you're
right. Rabbi Shaffer, very nice.
Love. Thank you.
See you again in a class, and we look forward to more.
Mirtz Hashem, 2 weeks' time, same time, same screen, I hope, and we look forward. Bezrat Hashem.
I'm going to tell my brother, I should have told him to come on, you know, now
please,
on Zoom.
Please.
He can certainly tune in. I totally forgot.
I forgot. I would have told.
We'll have to work it out.
Yeah, just get me the new info, and I'll redo the flyer.
Thank you.
And to the bakers,
bye, Helen.
Have a wonderful time in a very warm place.
All right.
Okay.
Take care, everybody.
Lila Tov.